Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
What does the education system of the future look like? The traditional education of the three R's, reading, writing and arithmetic, are great foundations, but what about teaching skills to young people who won't hit the workforce until 2040? Teachers are forever complaining about all the myriad of things that they're supposed to be teaching and say there's hardly time to teach what is already there. How do we predict the future nature of work? And more importantly, what does that mean for what we need to teach kids now? How can we know what to teach for a future that we know nothing about? We're told often, in fact, we've discussed it on this program, haven't we, about how the majority of jobs that are around now won't be around in the future. And that a lot of what people will be doing in the future, we don't know about yet. And I suppose in our own lives, that is true, wasn't it? Software programming, app developer. I mean, who on earth would have been an app developer in, say, the early 90s when such things didn't exist? Or if they did, existed in a tiny part of the computer world. These days, of course, it's commonplace. Tonight we're going to take a look at the workplace of the future, what kind of qualifications you might need, what jobs might simply disappear. Some say, for example, with the advent of electric cars, that, for example, traditional mechanic skills might not be necessary anymore. Not completely, of course, but in the way that they are now. My next guest says we need to take a wholesale look at the Australian education system. He says it's outdated, belongs to a bygone industrial revolution era. Pretty strong words, I would have thought. Joining me tonight, futurist Morris Misolowski, and he's in the studio with us. Morris, good evening.
Good evening, Phil.
Yes, everyone's got a view about education, yeah, don't they? It's why is what we're doing now not suited to the workplace of the future?
It doesn't speak to what we need it to do. Now, this is not a beat up about teachers, I promise you, because teachers are wonderful. I know that to be true firsthand.
Yeah, they are.
So this is more about a systemic issue, and I think more of a cultural issue as well. The system itself was set up basically, as you've said in the introduction, for an industrial revolution model, when it was fairly obvious what the outcomes of careers might be and what units of understanding we needed. So if I wanted to be a carpenter or a landscaper or a brain surgeon, I could predict 20 or 30 years out what I would need, and I could teach somebody in step towards that process. Today, as you've said already, that doesn't make sense. We don't know what the jobs of tomorrow are. We don't know what the tasks are.
Well, can I pick you up on that? I mean, we do. That's true. We don't. But then again, much of what education is about, particularly in the early stages, is about just acquiring some basic skills. In fact, we've just been talking in the news about the NAPLAN tests, which are all about just trying to get kids to basic levels of literacy and numeracy. Now, that's never going to go away, is it? We've got to be literate and numerate, whatever we might be doing.
We absolutely do. And that NAPLAN test is really an interesting conversation in and of itself. But the notion of education, if you go back to its definition, this is the very definition going back a couple of hundred years, is the process of receiving or giving systematic instruction. That's what education means in the dictionary. We're not able to do that anymore. Simply by the definition, we're going to fall by the wayside if that's what we continue to do, because we cannot be prescriptive. We can want to be, as parents, as teachers, as educators, we want to give our children the best, and we want to say to them that if you study this plus this plus this, the outcome will necessarily be this, and you will be able to have a career in that for the next 40 years. With all the intent in the world and all the love in the world, we just can't do that anymore. We're selling them a pup if we do. What we have to say to them is there are many foundational things that we can teach you, many things that you need to know in your early infancy. We want to show you what the world is. We want to teach you what it is to be a respectful citizen, what it is to live in our country, what it is to understand the basics of maths and analytics and language and do all of the things that are necessary. But what we're going to do that, the way we're going to do that is in an open-ended fashion, so that you can then use those as basic skills to move yourself forward through your careers. As you said, the reality for our kids, and this is the reality, the Australian Bureau of Statistics says so, and we can't argue with them. They say that our kids, the ones who are going into school today, will statistically live to 100. I believe they'll live to 120 and 150.
Mm. Now, certainly will live longer, won't they? I mean, I think my parents' generation, the life expectancy for men was getting on to 80. I mean, for
just nudging into the mid-70s.
Yeah, for us it's 85 now. That's what we can expect.
And that's incredible, because when I grew up, knowing an octogenarian, someone who was 80, was really unusual.
Mm.
It was normally a female, and she was often feeble. And that was, again, a pejorative comment, but that's generally what it was. It was unusual for anybody to make that innings. Today, many of us thankfully know 100-year-old people, and they're sprightly. They're really with it. They're not with the ring by any means.
Mm.
So if we take today's basis, this is not about technology. It's not about popping pills. It's really about the way we live our lives. We know enough about the body and enough about hygiene, enough about nutrition, enough about what sustains us as human beings to be able to make our lives longer and healthier. So that's where that comes from. When we begin to add into that the things that we think we're beginning to discover, the magic fountains of youth, of keeping us alive longer, that's what gives us that. But the important notion behind that is that if we're going to live to that length of time, we will have to do something meaningful with our lives beyond the current cutoff date of 65 or 70. Some for income, and that's not necessarily a good thing, especially if you toil or if you work hard with your hands.
Mm.
That could be a difficult thing to say. But putting that to aside, and I know it's not easy to do, we just can't sit there for 40 years and do nothing and twiddle our thumbs. We will want to do
something.
Well,
you won't have any money to do it anyway.
Well, absolutely. But even if you did, even if you're one of the very, very few, you have to do something to keep your brain alive. So we'll be doing many, many things into our much later lives. As you've said, I absolutely believe our kids will have 6 careers in their lifetimes. I think they'll have more, but 6 distinct careers, and they'll have 40 jobs in that life.
Mm.
Now, we're moving away from the 9-to-5 model that was wonderful Industrial Revolution.
Mm.
We're working project and task, and the biggest difference here is that the careers of the future will be simultaneous. They'll actually be doing 1 or 2 or 3 different income activities at any given time. As a baby boomer, I was told there's only one thing you can do in your life. Whatever that is, go to work, do it. Anything else was a waste of time.
Mm.
Part-time work might be great, but that was part-time work. It wasn't serious. So the career was what saw you through.
Although, yeah, I get that. Although, you know, we've been talking a bit about this on the program too. The increasing casualization of the workforce and the so-called gig economy, which is what you're talking about, the problem with it is that if you're trying to raise a family or buy a house or just do what most people want, young people want to do, that is meet someone, settle down, raise kids in a stable way, that's the trouble with the gig economy. It doesn't give you the stability that we have maybe been used to. What do you say about that?
It doesn't, but I'm not talking about a world where we are all part-time workers, where we're all gig workers and we're really at the behest of the wind and how it blows.
Correct. Yeah, yeah.
I'm still seeing a future where we most probably have one main income stream. There's one thing that we're able to do more often than something else, and that most probably is tied to a fixed income of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about the notion that that might not be 9-to-5, and it will allow us to have extra time to do other things. Using today's analogies, it's not uncommon to find somebody that might have a normal full-time job and then jump into an Uber car for a couple of hours a day, or maybe sell something on Etsy, or maybe go and do something through an Airtask or one of the other sites. What they're doing is supplementing income, and that's important, but for many people, it's actually about supplementing interests. There are other things with their lives that they want to do. And unlike a traditional baby boom where we had to wait till the weekend or till we retired to try those things, we'll be given a space in the future where we can in fact dabble in many things beyond what our normal activity is. That will be seen to be okay by society, it'll be accepted, and we'll be able to supplement income by that. So it's really a mixture, it's a portfolio of some fixed income and some general income as and when we want it for money and for interest.
Mm. Yeah, I wonder, do you think, I mean, maybe I'm just a bit of a stick in the mud about this. There's a lot of talk about robots, for example, and automation and their job sort of killing nature of it. But then again, there always has been talk about of what technology is going to do to kill jobs. And the lesson has been that as many jobs that it kills, it seems to create.
In fact, it creates more. I mean, you go back in history, and history is littered with exactly that comment.
Yeah.
When Henry Ford came along, and he wasn't the first, of course, but the example we use most often to talk about that era, it was also seen as the end of the era of the horseless cart, where all those jobs would disappear. And yes, they did.
They did.
And we lament the fact that the people that had them didn't have work and maybe couldn't put food on the table. I have nothing good to say about that. I don't wish that to be. But the reality was, as difficult as that was for those people, a whole new generation of workers rose up and had new skills, new activities, and new possibilities of work. And the ripple effect of the other of the broader economy, of things that went into car manufacturing, of people involved in allied industries, grew a whole new world. I do not believe in a world where robots, as we see them in science fiction, will walk around and be our overlords. I don't pay into a dystopian world where everything will go rotten because of it. Technology will, for me, only ever be an adjunct to human beings. We're on this planet for a reason. We're human beings. We will not allow it to happen, but we will have more technology in our lives. Having said that, we've always had technology in our lives. It just hasn't been things we plugged in. Every society on the planet's always made tools, always made different ways of working.
Exactly.
And use them effectively. The big difference with us is we plug them into a wall, so to speak. They are more overreaching than we've ever had them before. But we're still going to be human in every sense of the word.
My guest is futurist Morris Misalowski. We're talking about the future of education. We've got slightly off track. Rosemary called to say that the one mistake is confusing education with training. And that's an important distinction, isn't it? That, you know, because there's a view that really the only thing that you should ever teach, I mean, educate people about, sorry, you can teach people different things, that's training, but the only education that people need is an education which will enable them to think clearly, for example.
And that's what I think is most imperative. I mean, education to me is what we do throughout life.
Yeah.
It is that
we learn new skills all the time.
It is that ongoing thing that we do from literally the moment we're born till the moment we're not here anymore. And training, absolutely, as Rosemary said, as you've said, is the specific skills. How do we pick this up? How do we move it over to somewhere else? How do we change its character or its nature? In this new world that I see ahead. I mean, I did a talk today, this morning in Melbourne, to a group of year 9 to 12 students for IT, information technology, talking about what their careers would be. Wonderful group. I mean, if you're listening, Nilla and the others, are well done. It was actually a year 12 student that put this together and then invited other schools to come together. What I talked to them about and what we chatted about was the notion that information technology, which is what they think they want to do, in fact, doesn't exist anymore. That the notion of sitting there and coding in a dark room is something that was 20 years ago. I referred to it, and I've asked them to think about their life if they're going into this space as being life's architects. That what they're going to do is they're going to create the backdrop that allows us to go and do the human things in the front. So we will use technology increasingly to be able to move things backwards and forwards, to communicate, to buy, to sell. But in front of all of that will be humans. And much the same way as gas and electricity now is taken for granted, a lot of the technology that we are besotted by is also going to move into the background. We'll forget about it. What we're going to do over the next decade or so is begin to find purpose for these things. And that really is the space. So in this new education era, we're talking about creating. We're not talking about making. We're talking about a world where these children that are going to go into the workforce over the next 10 or 20 years will have to think about everything they do and question whether, in fact, they'll be doing it the same way tomorrow or next week and be given the latitude to be able to change within confines the way they do that. They're also going to see industries rise and fall. And one of the definitions I make, like Rosemary, is that I actually don't think we're going to lose a lot of jobs. I think we're going to lose a lot of tasks. I think that we'll still have, as humans, the needs for people to cook and to clean and to be doctors and to be lawyers and whatever else it is we want of
them. Well, yeah, there was a good point made. We were talking to some columnists the other night about corporations and, you know, and the robots, etc. And they were making the point that if you look at successful corporations today, they still, their biggest thing and the biggest thing they talk about is their human capital, the people who work for them. In other words, gathering good people together is the secret of success now, as it always has been.
As it always should have been, but we've forgotten that, I think, for the last couple of decades. The big corporations were very good at selling process. So if you look at the large accounting firms, for instance, I mean, we bless them, but what they did particularly well was process. So they had terrific auditors and accountants and other people that could massage figures and put together a document that was purposeful for the government or for you to move forward with. I was in there actually in one of the large four firms on Monday night for a meeting to talk about exactly this. And what I found fascinating was that this huge global corporation was talking about exactly that, that they no longer wanted to be seen to be doing those statutory documents. Yes, they'll do them, but that's background. What they were hiring now were wizards. They were hiring people with wisdom, and they were looking for what they called an ecosystem, a tribe. And they were literally going out to futurists, but they were also going out to sculptors and gardeners and all kinds of different people. Because what they realize is that they all have a different view on creativity. And what's fascinating, going back a couple of years already, if you look at Ernst & Young and Google and PwC and all sorts of other large corporations, they have all said that they no longer hire predominantly on qualification or your mark. What they're looking for is somebody that has shown aptitude. So yes, you've gone and done some kind of an accounting qualification, but what they want to see is the human, because they realize that increasingly what they're going to sell to their clients is face-to-face, that the person that has that skill has to be competent enough to be able to carry on a great conversation and represent them well. So they now hire more on aptitude and personal skills and take for granted the fact that you have that qualification. And that's the move, as you've said, and I'm beginning to see that we're seeing across this whole corporate space.
Okay. Futurist Maurice Misolofsky is with us this evening. We're talking about the future of education. Maurice's view is that the traditional 3 hours of education are great foundations, but our kids also need the 3 C's, communication, collaboration, and creativity. I think you're onto something there, aren't you? That this ability to work together with people in teams, to get on with people, and you know what we've often talked about in the past is emotional intelligence, are highly valued skills these days.
And the only thing that we'll be able to sell, let's transport ourselves 5 or 10 years from now. A lot of the skills that we now have that are tasks that people do in their jobs will increasingly be done by technology. We've got artificial intelligence almost on the horizon. I actually don't think it exists, but we have machine learning, whatever you want to call it. In other words, we have machines that are almost ready to start to do some of the thinking for us. And we're seeing white-collar jobs disappear because of it. So if we take away much of the mundane routine work, what's left for humans to do? If we do nothing, then we're left totally unemployed. The only thing that we can do after machines take over the routine work, because we've asked them to, is for us to be wise, is for us to be human. And I think that's where we're headed. I'm hoping that's where we're headed. And the only way we can do that is by the 3 C's. It's imperative that our children have great communication skills. I'm not just talking about the ability to speak, because that's important, but the ability to write. Remembering that we're communicating now on a global scale. They're talking to people across cultures, across times, with different thought processes. They're coming in and out of different tribes of work, doing different things, and they have to be able to be heard and be able to hear and be able to put their points of view succinctly to be able to get on in the world. So it's a really important space. The C for community is also, for me, absolutely important, because we will have to work together. What we're seeing now in most workspaces is, even if we don't work as a team ongoing, we're still collaborating more than we ever did before. So we've got to be able to get on with people, to get the best out of each other in that space. And creativity is imperative, because, as we said earlier, the jobs of the future, the tasks of the future, will require us to use human skills to actually analyze what we're doing ongoing and to question where there's a better way to do it. Now, better doesn't mean we've gotten smarter, but it means there's some new technology, there's some new landscape, something's happening. As we know, there's always things bubbling. There's something happening on the horizon.
Do you say this, actually, I'll ask you this in a moment, because I know Joe wants to have a chat with you. Joe, g'day. You've been a teacher for a while?
Yeah, about a bit over 30 years.
You say you might know... You might know a thing or two, Joe.
Well, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like I know nothing, but I started as a classroom teacher, and I've gradually developed into a PE teacher, but I just feel like teaching across the board, no matter what you're teaching, is pretty much the same kind of methods that you use. And I'd agree with Maurice that schools, when I started in the 80s, what we were trying to achieve back then, nothing like what we're trying to do now, and the world has changed, and I think to teach children to be curious and creative, and I think I said to the lady on the phone earlier that schools are communities, first and foremost, and in a community is where you learn to get along with one another and work with one another, and they're just a microcosm of our broader society. So if we can teach children how to do that, I work in primary education.
Yep.
If we can teach children how to do that at that level, then it's going to have massive benefits for when they're in their adolescent period and then when they become adults. And those are skills that I think everyone needs throughout life. And working with families, like, it's really important to work with families. And so schools, are the borders of the school, you know, they're not there anymore.
Yeah, what do you think about that, Morris?
I mean, I absolutely agree. I go back to the old adage, Joe, too, that it takes a village to raise a child, and I think it's the same with education. I love the thought process, which you've seen the change of, as have I. When I went to school, yes, we made platitudes about being part of a community, but everything that was done was about the individual. The assessment was about me. The teaching was about me. Today, what we're finding in most classrooms is, yes, we want to assess whether I've learned something, but I do that in a very collaborative sense. We're actually beginning to show, we're beginning to give children the possibility they should be working together. So I'm absolutely up on that with you, Joe. I mean, I think that's the most incredible space. And also the notion, the basic notion of education has changed, because when I went to school, and I'm sensing that it's a similar time as to you, Joe, is the education system, again, with the best of intent, was all about just in case. It filled our head with information just in case we needed it down the track. What we're moving to is a system which is different. And what we will do is work into a system that will give us information just in time, just enough, and just for me. And that will be ongoing through life. So even when we get into our careers and into our work, we will use technology that will know what we learn and what we need to learn to be able to complete the task we're about to do. And it will teach us at that moment. It will accredit it for us, audit it, make sure that we're competent to do it, and then release us to do it. And this education is lifelong, so we've got a totally different relationship with it.
Joe, can I ask you another question?
Yes.
Yeah. You, as a teacher, you've had to work with students, you know, at all levels of ability. I mean, one of the things that worries me going into the future, and I want to ask you this too, Morris, is but get Joe's view first, though, is that that part of the thing that worries me is how you equip students, because, you know, the plain fact is kids come in a variety of shapes and sizes and abilities. You know, not everyone's the smartest button in the class.
Yes.
And you know, teaching so that even kids at the bottom end of the class also have, you know, have opportunities in life to live a full life. I wonder what you think about that. Is that a challenge increasingly or not?
Very much so. I think one of the buzzwords in education these days is passion.
Yep.
And I think as a teacher of as many years as I have been, to continue to have the passion for teaching as well as helping students to find whatever their passion is probably the secret to those group of children you're talking about, whether that's the children who are underachieving or who need to be challenged. And I have my own children who are fall into both of those categories.
Yep.
At times. I reckon the passion, finding really what you love doing, because I've got a 9-year-old, and over the last few years he's told me what he wants to be when he grows up, and it keeps on changing naturally. And it's about finding what you love doing, and of course that's going to change, as you said before, a number of times over your life. But you've got to have those broad skills that are going to transfer across any profession. But yeah, particularly finding what you love and what is your passion, because no matter how clever or how difficult things are in life, everyone's got some sort of passion in something.
Yep, no, I agree with that. All right, thanks, Joe. Appreciate it. Thank you.
No worries.
Good on you. Bye-bye. Thanks for the call, too. I mean, I see your head nodding here, Morris. I mean, that chimes with you as well, doesn't it?
It does. It's what I told the students today. It's what I always tell them, that this is not one career choice anymore. Mm. What you have to do is find the path that gives you the most joy, that makes you want to get up in the morning, that at this stage in your life you think is most likely to take you where you want to be, and start walking down that path, because it will change and bend. And with all the best of love and intent in the world, we can't tell you exactly how it's going to be. But that's the journey. But I want to go back to one point earlier. You talked about the bottom end of class, and we talk about those students that are struggling at the moment.
You know, well, can I say, I suppose I want to say something else too, which is that not everyone has, you know, has the same level of abilities. People have different levels of abilities. And some, you know, some people are smarter than others. That's the plain fact it is. And some people can do really complicated jobs. Other people can't do those jobs. But there have always been a variety of jobs for people.
Yeah.
Moving ahead into the future, projecting yourself into the future, which is the space you're in, are we still going to see that same range of jobs?
We can, but I want to go back to the fundamentals and then come back to the future because I can answer both of them. Mm-hmm. Firstly, I think the first one, I have difficulty with that, and I understand what you're saying, and I certainly have felt and still do occasionally feel the same way. But what we're really arguing is that given the current system and the way we educate and the way that we assess students, they do not fit into that model. Mm-hmm. Therefore, they represent themselves as being an outlier. They represent themselves as not being the academic that this assessment
holds them up
to be.
They're often made to feel dumb, aren't
they? When in fact they're not. I mean, they're not anything. What they are having difficulty doing is shoehorning themselves into a system that doesn't accept them well. Mm-hmm. Yes, I understand that children have difficulty. Yes, I understand they're learning. I'm not for a moment putting a Pollyanna gloss on that. And I know that teachers have difficulty coping with it, that in a classroom of 20 or 30 students, you can only do so much with one pair of hands and one brain. But the reality is that it's not the student, I feel often, it's the system. It is the system because we do not have a way that we can envelop and get them to move forward. Now, moving forward, there's actually some new technology, and I know we keep coming back to technology, but I think this is a really worthwhile piece. It's called learning analytics, and we're just on the cusp of being able to introduce this. Now, I'm a futurist. A cusp doesn't mean tomorrow. It means within the next couple of years. We are that close. Mm-hmm. And I would say within 10 years, most educational institutions will be doing this.
What is it?
So what we have then is the ability from here on in to attach a child to a piece of technology. I don't mean physically, but I mean whatever they use, whether it's their laptops or their books or anything else in the classroom. And this piece of technology monitors that one student from the moment they start in kindergarten throughout their lives. It knows how they learn, what they learn. In the classroom, it monitors them. So it understands they're having difficulty with that maths problem or with that piece of curriculum. And it gives them information. It gives them different learning styles. We talk about the ability for learning different learning styles, kinesthetic learners. We have all kinds of different learners. So it adapts to their specific needs, matching the curriculum outcomes, but changing the world just for them. It's sending information back to the academics and also to the teacher in the classroom. And the teacher's role here, because this is imperative, there will always be teachers in classrooms that I'm concerned about. I always want teachers in there, physical human beings. But what the teacher will do is actually pick it up from the point of where the technology says, look, I've had a look at Morris's work. We've tried this, we've tried that, we've done this. This is the level he's at. This is where he's stuck. Mm-hmm. And the teacher will be able to come in and take me from that position of being stuck and move me forward. Now, the student, again, I do not want to paint the picture that we're talking about students working with technology, but this is a backdrop. This is behind the scenes, the students involved and enveloped in this. So we're constantly aware of where they're at and where they're struggling and where they're succeeding. And what this falls into for me is that I'm hoping that we'll get to the position in a decade or so where we might do away with lots of the assessments as we know them, because what we will have is a far better minute-by-minute understanding of what Morris or Phil is capable of. Mm-hmm. That will be the assessment that we'll use more often to judge them by. So what we will be saying is, according to their capabilities and their learning journey, this is where they've succeeded, this is where they have issues.
Okay. All right. Ruth, hello.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Hey, Ruth.
Hi, Morris. I just wanted to comment. We live just outside of Canberra, and there's a township just outside of Canberra currently being built, and our children actually attend a school locally there. Mm-hmm. What's amazing and exciting about that school is that they actually are looking at the future and how our children will learn. And more specifically, actually using those methodologies to teach the children. So instead of actually mainstream schooling, where you go and sit in the classroom and have desks, the children go into a classroom which has ottomans and desks, and they acknowledge that all children work differently and all children learn differently. And as a result of that, they actually teach the children how to learn. And from that scaffolding, then the children can actually learn and adapt to what they're learning at that time or that subject. So the foundations of this, I believe, come through a gentleman from the UK called Guy Claxton, and he looks at learning muscles, and I think there's about 16 in total, and these learning muscles include things like collaboration, teamwork, perseverance, and things like that. And as a result of that, I think that really does provide the children with a foundation to then adapt to what their jobs will be in the future and how they will learn in the future.
Yeah, Morris? Yeah.
And absolutely. I mean, thanks for that, Ruth. That really is the foundations of what we're talking about, whether it's Guy or others, and there are many people in this space, but he's certainly one of the most credible. It really is this notion that one size doesn't fit all anymore, that the education system really has to allow not only itself to be flexible, but for students to be totally flexible, because the outcome of it is that we have to put out great citizens, because we're going to live in this world. We have to put out great citizens that are competent and able to do what we want, that are good citizens and will be able to adapt to whatever is ahead of them. And these sorts of systems do it because they don't talk about one outcome only. They talk about the possibilities of a multi-outcome.
Morris, what about universities and higher education? I mean, not everyone can or should necessarily attend university, but I participated recently in a discussion on the future of universities, and one of the views being put there was that universities as they exist at the moment might be in peril in this globalised education world, where people will pick and choose the courses or the teachers they want from around the world and put their own courses together. Do you think there's something in that?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, one of the reasons I'm in Sydney is tomorrow I'm delivering a keynote address to some of these illustrious universities in Sydney, talking about what the future is. And certainly one of the things, I'm preempting now, so I hope not many of them are listening, or they might be bored tomorrow, like
everyone,
the students might be.
Everyone listens tomorrow. This is true.
No, sorry, I should have said. I take for granted that they're listening. But the reality is that one of the things I want to say to them tomorrow is that we need to start selling off some of the leaseholds, some of the landholds that they have, because they will not need all that property. We will have higher education moving forward. There's no two ways about it. But higher education will not be this process that we understand it to be now, where we physically attend a building for 2, 3, 5 years, 7 years, depending on what the course is. At the end of the course, we're accredited and we walk away ready to do the task. We need to do lots of things in this space. One of the things that I'm passionate about is that we need to have a global qualification. We need to move into a space where if I accredit myself as being competent in a skill, that skill should then be seen across the world. Now, I absolutely accept there'll be regionalization. There are things that are different, but that should be a top-up, because the world we're moving into with our children is a global world. So they should be able to apply their craft wherever possible across it. We also need to understand that many of the skill sets that they will be doing in that career don't exist, and universities cannot, with the best of intent, teach them. What they will do is give them a foundation, an understanding of what the thinking is, what the language, the culture of that particular job is, and what the thinking is, and today's best understanding of how to do it. Where I think universities need to change their game, and this is not because they're lazy, it's because it's a new landscape, they've not had to do it before, is that they will need to set up a relationship with students that are ongoing through life. There is this wonderful thing that I call nano degree, because I've not found a better word for it, but a nano degree is what I described earlier, that if I'm a carpenter, if I'm a builder, if I'm a doctor, and I've been taught this particular qualification, one day I come up against something that I've not had to do before, but it's in the skill set of what this profession does. I'll be given an immediate course in that, and that can be online, it can be in a piece of technology. Let's not worry about how it's delivered, but it's delivered to you because that learning analytic I described earlier knows your competency and it knows you're not quite capable yet. It will deliver it. It will instruct you in it. This could be a minute, it could be a day, it could be a week, it could be a month. It depends on what's relevant to your knowledge and understanding. It will then, after it's accredited for you, audit it and allow you to go into the workplace and do it and monitor you. And this is the landscape that I think our higher education needs to go into, that it's not just providing the one-off opportunity of giving you just-in-case learning, but giving you the just-in-time, just-enough, just-for-me approach all the way through.
Yes, Ali from Bungendore says, thanks for the program topic. The way of the future is big picture education and 21st century fluencies. It works on passion learning and one student at a time. You might agree with that. That the class is going to be less important than the individual.
I'm not so sure, because again, we go back to community, we go back to all the things we spoke about before. But it's certainly for the first time ever, if you talk to anyone in education, and I am a qualified teacher in higher education and have been in the space for a long time, even though my landscape is larger than that. If you talk to anybody in this space, the one thing that they've always craved to do is to give each student individual attention, but they haven't been able to. The mechanics of a classroom just doesn't allow it to happen, even with the best of intent. where we can let technology now do the heavy lifting of that. And again, we're not talking about robots. We're talking about being able to assess and know that students are competent and humans can walk in and out of spaces as required. We begin to actually achieve the one student notion that we've always talked about giving. And that's what I'm most joyful and most hopeful about in tomorrow's landscape, that we will get to a space very quickly where every student is catered for, regardless of whether they fit into some criteria or not.
Okay. Ken, hello.
Hello, yes.
Hey, Ken.
Yep. I'm sorry about that. You caught me on the hop here.
That's right.
One of the things that's always concerned me over the years is today people seem to think that literacy is hitting spell check on their Word program. I don't think any of them have got a clue what a dictionary is.
Yeah, what do you think about this, Morris? Yeah. Is that important? Is it important that people know how to spell, or is it important that they know how to find out how to spell?
Both. I mean, both. Ken's not going to like this answer. I don't think it's as important as it once was. And I don't mean that it's not important to know the end result, because I'm from your school. I absolutely agree with that. But the reality of today's students, given that the way that they will work, is that I believe they need to have enough to be dangerous, meaning they have to have foundations. They have to know the basic grammar structure. They have to understand how language is put together.
Exactly. Yeah.
They have to understand that 2 plus 2 can't equal 12. It doesn't matter how much you try. But beyond that, the actual heavy lifting of day-to-day will be done by technology. Now, you and I, Ken, can lament that and wish we go back to those days, because they are important. But the reality is, with the way that they're going to move forward, we have to give them enough to know and to be competent, but they will always refer back to technology.
You need to know the rules of grammar because otherwise you can't write clearly, Morris.
You can't
intuitively write clearly. Just can't.
And I agree with that. But Mrs. Ruby, which was my grade 4 teacher, and I'm sure she's gone to God by now, spent the entire year trying to make me rote learn my times table and really didn't succeed at it. And I think I spent 3 or 4 years being told by various teachers about rote learning of my tables. Now, not that that's not important, but I'm suggesting to you that maybe we don't need years of it. Maybe we need a year or two of it, and we could use that time for other things.
I'm a bit with you, Ken. I actually did rote learn my tables. I suspect you did too.
As did I.
As did Morris. And I found it spectacularly useful skill in life, actually.
But and again, that made sense for the world that you and I grew up in, because we didn't have a point of reference. Yeah. The whole point of education, I believe, going backwards, was that education was there, again, this just in case, because you and I didn't have ready reference. If we didn't know it, then there was no real way of us finding it quickly.
That's true. Well, that is true today, Ken. If you don't know how to spell a word, it's very easy to fix it.
And that's what it comes down to. It's really the trade-off. It's not that it's a bad thing. It's that we have to have this trade-off in life of at what point do we say that's sufficient and we move on to other skills and other traits that need to be learned.
Yes, you say that there are a whole lot of jobs that will disappear.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like what?
I suppose we can
already predict some of them.
Well, we can, and you don't need me to do that. But the easiest way to categorise them is anything that's repetitive, anything that can be taught to a computer as a what-if statement or a 1 plus 1 is likely to and is already disappearing. Now, don't for a moment think that this is just what traditionally is called blue-collar jobs. We're actually finding the traditional white-collar jobs are disappearing as well.
Yeah.
So a lot of the back-end bookkeeping, accounting, legal work, in law, there is this really big issue at the moment going around. I mean, I've worked with lawyers and all sorts of people for years on this, and they have always believed that because of the way that the government and politics and everything else cocoons them, that they were almost immune to this new world. We now have what is called artificial intelligence. I've said to you already, I don't believe it, but we have machine learning. We have this thing called ROS, R-O-S-S, which is IBM Watson. It's that computer that won Jeopardy and played chess and did all that thing we've seen the last couple of years. It already takes the position of law clerks in America, and there are tens of thousands of traditional law clerks that are losing their job and no longer being employed. These are the ones that you and I might see in the shows.
What do they do?
So in the show, whenever we watch one of those law firm shows, there are these people that sit there in the library with tombs of books.
That's right.
And their role is to amass all of the precedent and put together a case and then give that across to the legal expert to use. That's a library catalogue, and that's being done by Ross now. And Ross does it in the space of a minute, and it does it with the most up-to-date information. You have physicians and doctors that are using it to help with a prognosis and a diagnosis. Again, never patient-facing, but for them as a tool. So the things that traditionally would have been done by people that we would have said were wisdom jobs are now becoming things that are being done by technology. So those sorts of jobs are the ones that are going to disappear if they haven't already, and it is right across the board.
Mm-hmm. Okay, George, hello.
Hey, George.
G'day, George.
I'm interested in what you're saying. What I've been talking about my students today, I exited the university in Canberra, and I said to the students today that part of my job is to drill a hole in your head and put in facts, but you'll probably forget those fairly quickly, and they're probably mostly irrelevant. What I need you to be able to do is to develop the higher cognitive processes, like understanding, analysing problems, and coming up with good solutions. And I think that's an important skill that will help us be more flexible in our future work lives, rather than simply remembering facts.
Absolutely, and that is very much where the landscape of tomorrow is. Again, as past learners, we might lament that. That's not the system we grew up with, and we know what that system has been able to produce us as a workforce and as a nation, and we're thankful for that. But moving forward, again, as we've said already this evening, that doesn't serve us as well. It really is about what you've just said, George. It's about opening up students to that world that they want to be involved with, to giving them the foundations. Yes, tell them what we know now, but as you've said, you leave that hole in their head open. And you leave it open because they know it constantly is going to be refreshed and filled throughout their lifetime.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah. Thanks, George. Yeah. What about the notion? This is another thing that interests me about some of this. I mean, I agree with you about a lot of it. I think that's probably right. I mean, reluctantly, I kind of agree with you about spelling, really, even though...
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, I'm not comfortable saying it, but I know it to be true.
No, neither am I, but I think that's probably right, that there are machines today which will fix your spelling. So therefore, yes. Why do you need to know it as much as you did? Probably not. What about the notion of cultural understanding and the power of story and so on? People study history, for example, not for not always to find out what happened so much, but as to understand that human society is often the same, regardless of where we come from. That if we understand where we've been, we understand better where we're going. And that's always been one of the great powers of story and culture and civilization.
I think
those sort of things are not easily replicated by machines, are they?
No, and that goes back to the human factor. I think it's imperative that we teach that. In fact, that's where I want to loosen up the curriculum, to get away from the rote learning to do that. As a futurist, one of the things that I've used for the last 30 years to be able to talk about the landscape of tomorrow is what I believe is what I believe an understanding of human nature. In fact, as humans throughout the millenniums, we really only want to resolve very few issues. There are only a handful of issues that as humans we want, but we go about creating and having them differently in every generation. When you look at the things that we think are incredible today, they are really often only reincarnations of things we did in the old days, but very differently. Today we talk about things like, you talked about the gig economy. Mm. We had part-time jobs. We had all kinds of things before. I love this notion of Uber and home and all these things delivered to us. But when I grew up, home delivery was ordinary. It was the only way you got the milk and the bread and the eggs.
That's right.
But all of a sudden we seem to have reinvented as if it's brand new.
That's right. Mm.
I think the only thing that one of the things we can do with our students is exactly what you've said, is to give them a sense of purpose, a sense of what it means to be human, and an understanding of what it is we need to achieve as a race, so that they can go ahead and recreate that world for themselves.
Mm. Brian, you wanted to make a point about teaching trades?
Yeah, mate.
Hey, Brian.
How are you?
Good.
Mate, in my trades, in the automotive trades, I won't say which trades are relevant in some respects, but they have this new method of where they put a lot of stuff on the computer and the kids go through, or kids and young adults go through and do a lot of stuff on computers and get a lot of their training that way. In the meantime, I've spoken to TAFE teachers and say that's great because the universities now owns their local TAFE and they think that's a great way to learn, but the trouble is they've got no hand skills.
Mm. And the trouble, yeah, and exactly. In automotive mechanics, indeed, you know, I've spent some time, you know, with high-level trade skills as well, and hand skills are hugely important, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all those skills are absolutely vital. And, Brian, you're absolutely right. But, again, I don't think that's a fault of the education system. I think it's the fault of the way we roll it out. I think that we're pushing kids in front of screens to be able to answer questions about the trade when we should, in fact, be pushing them in front of a motor and asking them to disassemble and reassemble it. We've kind of gone too far on the other way of ticking boxes to say that the curriculum's been met. And, again, I talk about this from a first-hand viewpoint, that we're so often tied to a curriculum that has to prove that student's walked its way through it. That we really don't release enough time to actually do the doing of it. And that's what I think we're seeing in the TAFE system.
That's the point you're making, is it, Brian?
There is another way. You get it and get them assessed. You take the kid through through tasks, and the same kids, I remember it when I went through back in 85, 6 and 7. We were taken through the same tasks and on a lot of time frame and see how we went. And I was had the teacher looking over me while I was 2 minutes out of the 5 minutes into the task, and he gave me a concerned look. I thought, geez, he spotted me missing something. So in the end, I went back over everything, and then in the end, I got the task done, the start of the motor. He said, what? And he said, you're ready to break the state record. I thought he'd do me do something wrong. But that's what you do. You get kids out there, and I know they're not all kids, but you get them out there, you put them on things and see how they go. It's not quite real world, but it's close to it.
Yeah.
And what you're describing, Brian, in fact, is the trick of the trade that I use. I mean, I've talked about all sorts of fancy things tonight. Mm-hmm. Really what I've described to you is what we did hundreds of years ago and we've done forever. We had guilds and apprenticeships, and that's how we taught most people to work. Mm. It was actually the physical doing of it. And they would physically do that job for 5, 6, 7 years until we deemed them competent. It wasn't the books that was important. It was the doing. And that's where I want us to get back to. Technology actually allows that to happen. We can use it in a virtual sense. We can do all kinds of things that we've not been able to do before. But as a society, we have to be willing to say that we're releasing the shackles of the way we used to educate. We're thanking it for what it's given us up until now. But in order to honour what it's meant to do, we've got to change some of the ways we deliver and what we give.
A futurist, Morris Misilowski, is with us this evening. We're talking about the future of education. What do you say we should say to... I don't know, I'm a parent. I've, you know, a parent of young women out in the world just completing their education. What do you say to kids who are finishing school, finishing, you know, TAFE, finishing uni, finishing their training, whatever it might be, who say, I'm not sure what I want to do? What's the best advice you think? Because that's a common thing.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Look, the first
what's the best advice?
The first thing I think we need to do as parents is to say, yes, that's an honest response. Because the first thing we do as parents is we try and closet them in. No, you've got to find something. You've got to find a path. For me, and I can tell you that I have two children. One of them is going through this at the very moment, just finished her qualification, literally, in July. My advice to her is that she needs to find a road to hoe that is relevant to the qualification she took and experiment with it. Mm. I've told her this will not be a lifelong journey for her at this stage.
In other words.
Do something.
Yeah.
Start the journey. It doesn't matter where the journey starts. Start the journey.
It's not likely that you'll finish there.
You're not going to. I mean, this is not the 40-year career job with GMH or Holden or Ford or whatever we had in the old days. Start. Make sure that's something you do. Use the skills. I've talked to her about, until she finds something else, going out and finding maybe some philanthropy, maybe doing something in the community that uses the same skills. Whatever it is that she can do to ply those trades until she finds her path, to me, is imperative. Mm. Yes, she'll need to produce some income, but I totally believe that will come. But we need to free them up where they can do that. The reality is that many jobs moving forward will not be found. They'll have to be created. That's the other difficulty. And on another night, perhaps we'll talk about the notion that I don't think there'll be enough work for everybody moving forward over the next 30 or 40 years. And that's a whole different landscape.
That's a contested area, isn't it? Because, you know, a lot of economists say, yeah, we've always said this, and there always has been work.
Yeah, but what we have now is 24 million going up to 37 to 40 million in Australia by 2050. Mm. We've got 7 billion globally going up to over 10 billion. We've got a rising middle class. We have things that we've never seen before in demographics.
But won't they be doing jobs that we've never heard of?
They will not be enough for all them to do. Remember, we started the conversation by saying we're living to 100 and working longer with more people doing more stuff.
Mm.
There will be tasks for us to do. But the notion of work being this 9-to-5 thing that everybody is entitled to and everybody has, unfortunately, I think, will be a relic of the past 50 years from now. And we'll have to address that as a society. It's a very broad issue.
Mm. But this issue, this idea, that's right, that it's, that if you're starting your working life, to some degree, it doesn't matter.
Just start.
Yeah. To some degree, it doesn't matter as long as you get into something that you're a bit interested in, at least, and that's relevant, at least, to some of your training.
Meaningful purpose will do it in a number of ways if you have to try it. Just start somewhere.
Yeah, if you're finished doing a mathematics degree, it's probably not a brilliant idea to start as an advertising copywriter.
Possibly not.
But you never know what might happen after that. No, exactly. It sounds like we're trying to reinvent the wheel educationally, says Brian. There are both practically and theoretical students. But we don't recognise it today. Yeah, maybe. Maybe. I wonder whether we actually sometimes artificially divide people like that.
I think that's the problem with our education.
What are all
system.
The displaced law clerks going to do? Says my texter. Well, the answer is we don't know, do we?
Well, we don't at this stage, but no. They'll have to find tasks. I mean, they have great analytical tasks. There are lots of things that they can do. They'll have to find another path
they
moving forward.
They can aggregate information. Yeah, exactly. All right. But fascinating talking, Maurice. Look forward to talking again.
Look forward to it.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.